The Healthcare Quality Cast is powered by the Quality Coaching Company. If you'd like to work with us to earn your Lean Six Sigma for healthcare certification or partner with our innovative corporate training and coaching programs to successfully scale your continuous improvement initiatives, then click the link below to learn more and apply.
Hey, quality people, welcome to the Healthcare Quality Cast. I'm your host, Jarvis Gray, and in this podcast, we spotlight today's most exciting and inspiring industry leaders. We dive deep into the career journeys of these leaders that work daily to improve quality, safety, and service outcomes for their patients, their family members, and their communities at large. Our mission is to provide motivation and direction to our listeners, encouraging you all to continue your efforts in improving the overall quality of healthcare. Now, let's meet today's quality guests. Thank you for joining in on another episode of the Healthcare Quality Cast. And today I'm here with my guest, Dr. Sean Griffin. Sean, are you ready to share with some quality people?
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
All right. Well, Sean, we love to start every show with positive affirmations just to get our momentum going. So I would love if you could please share a favorite leadership quote or leadership mindset, but tell us why it appeals to you and how do you apply it on a daily basis?
Well, one of the things that when I was coming up as being a leader, there are all of these different leadership, you know, methodologies and ideas and those sort of things. And, you know, when I came into medical training, we still had some very residual sort of captain of the ship, you are the god of the room sort of training that went into physicians and their training. And I never could adapt to that. I'm actually a family practice doctor by background. And one of the things that I have taken to heart is that as a family practice doctor, there's an old saying, know what you know and know what you don't know, and never try and fool people. And so much of my career in medicine, I was managing people who were experts in small areas, but I had to keep the whole patient in mind. And so when it comes to managing people, managing business, anything like that, I always say, I know what I know and I know what I don't know, and I'm not going to try and fool you. And my management idea is to be a coach. Because as a coach, you don't have all the skills of your players, but you have to make sure that they work together. And so I believe in trying to orchestrate a team to perform at its best point. And that means that I have to know what they know and know what they don't know and not set them up for failure and put them into situations where they're successful. So everything I do, whether it be strategic planning, whether it be leadership development, I think it's really important that you know your people and you understand them. And also there are times where you need to be the bad guy. I like to be the good guy. You know, you like to be friendly and all this sort of stuff, but there is that aspect of accountability. But accountability should never be shaming. And I think that as we go through leadership and as we look at quality, you know, you can set people up to fail or you can set them up to succeed. And even if you set them up to succeed, doesn't mean they're going to succeed every time. And you still want to care for the person. So that's just sort of a general principle I follow.
No, I love both of those thoughts. And your quote there, know what you know what you don't know, don't try to fool people. I mean, I literally just wrote that down. That is probably about to turn into an instant classic. I've never heard that, and it just resonated right out the gate with. So really love that mindset.
Thank you.
Let me move to the next question. You mentioned already your background as a family practice physician, but I want to go deep because I want to understand and help our audience understand the journey that has you sitting as president and CEO of URAC. So, Sean, I would love if you could just share your current role, your professional background, but definitely tell us a story of how you got to where you are now.
Oh, the stories are what make things memorable. So I'll start off a little far back, but I'll work towards it. So I'm the president and CEO at URAC. URAC is an accrediting organization based in Washington, D.C. I'm sitting about 8 blocks northeast of the White House right now in our offices. And what we do is we are an accreditor, which means we are an independent verifier of quality throughout the healthcare landscape. We started back around 1990. Most people who've been on this will have heard of accrediting organizations, whether it be the Joint Commission and CQA, ACHC. There's a number of accrediting organizations within healthcare, and what we do is we set the bar for quality, and we set it nationwide, and we bring together experts from various fields who know what they know, and we ask them to put together a set of standards. We put the standards out there in the public. We get feedback on them, and then we have organizations that come to us and they apply for accreditation. And one of the things I talk about is that regulation sets the bar for safety, and accreditation sets the bar for quality. And also, when you're doing accreditation, you sometimes get to highlight excellence. And I think that as we think about healthcare, you know, most people who come into healthcare don't know what they're looking at. You know, they're not experts in the field. Well, we are the experts in the field. And I've used the analogy, we're kind of like the Better Business Bureau or a good housekeeping seal of approval. If you look at some organizations, you go to their website, you'll see the URAC Gold Star. And that gold star means that somebody who is independent, in particular for our organization, we don't sell consulting services. So it's not like we sell a group consulting services and then we go in and have them pass a test that we just trained them for, which is kind of a thing that I think is a conflict of interest in accreditation. But we will go in and we will test them. And then we will actually take all the information that we find out about an organization. We will scrub it so that you can't tell who the organization is. And then we take it to an independent body within our organization called our accreditation committee. And they say, yes, they passed, or no, they didn't pass. So think about that. We don't sell consulting services. We set standards with nationwide experts, and then we go in and we actually check your work. And I say, you know, if everybody was expected to weigh the amount that's on their driver's license and nobody ever checked it, you know, the difference between what we say and what we're really doing is sometimes significant. And in healthcare, you know, the difference between reality and reputation can be the difference in life and death. So that's just my current job. I'm the president and CEO. I'm the first physician to sit in this role. I'm going to go back into my history, if that's okay with you, just sort of my path to get here, because it's unbelievable. I grew up in a small town in Iowa, a little town called Fayette, Iowa. When I was in fifth grade, because of the support and prompting of a teacher that I had, who was a wonderful key person in my life, I decided to become a doctor. There's no physicians in my family. I come from a background of teachers and educators, and I thought that I wanted to be a doctor. And that was actually influenced by Hawkeye Pierce from the TV series MASH. And you know, Hawkeye was this, he was funny, people liked him, he got to do good things and help people, and he stirred up a little bit of trouble. And if you're a fifth grade boy, that's really a great job description. I mean, think about it. You get to help people and you stir up trouble and everybody likes you and you're funny and all those sort of things. So I decided I wanted to be a doctor. And at the time, I mean, in small town Iowa, my idea of being a doctor wasn't, oh, I'm going to be a cancer researcher or anything like that. It was, I'm going to be a family practice doctor. You know, and to me, family practice is the small town doc. You know, you're on the sidelines for the football game on Friday nights. You know, maybe you're checking somebody for a concussion at your kitchen table or something like that. I mean, it's just that sort of environment. And I was fortunate enough to go to the University of Iowa College of Medicine and graduate from there. And I went to a rural family medicine residency in Mason City, Iowa, for 3 years is what they were doing at the time. And this is back when long hours were the standard, not illegal. So, I mean, this was every other night call for 3 years. This was times where I would work more than 100 hours in a week. And there were also times during this where I was the only doctor covering an emergency room in an entire county in Iowa. And that's a really sort of on the needle tip experience. You know, I had people come in who were having heart attacks. I had people come in who were burn victims. And I'm this family practice resident out there just trying to take care of a community. Now, I had community backup and those sort of things. But that really taught me about rural medicine and taking care of a community. And I came out of residency and I went and I practiced in St. Joseph, Missouri at a place called Heartland Health, now called Mosaic Life Care. And they were a great organization. And it was me and five partners in this office practicing medicine. And one of my funny things is when I was growing up, I was part of that first generation that was around computers in elementary school. Now, in my elementary school, I figured out how to do it, and I was showing some of the teachers some of the time. But it was part of my you know, elementary school, high school, college, medical school, those sort of things. And when I went into practice, I was like, I had recognized at that point that the technology for knowledge management went very well with medicine, because no doctor knows everything. And so how do you look it up? How do you find it when you need to find it? And so information management was an idea that I sort of brought into practice. And so I actually became the first chief medical information officer for my system in Missouri, and helped with this major technology transformation. We were a Cerner demonstration site for Cerner out of Kansas City, and we were helping them build stuff and try stuff and those sort of things, and was pretty successful. Because of that, I got recognized for being successful with EMR implementations, and I was hired away to go to Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. I was their first chief medical information officer. And going from St. Joseph, Missouri with 60,000 people to, you know, Houston, Texas with 6 million people, the first time that I actually rode in a car into the Texas Medical Center, I thought I was in the downtown of a major city, because the Texas Medical Center looks like a downtown unto itself. And you have some of the leading organizations in the world in medicine right there. And so I was Baylor College of Medicine, this small town doc coming to Baylor College of Medicine to be their first CMIO, and I was implementing Epic. So I implemented Cerner, and then I implemented Epic. After about a year or so, I moved over to the Memorial Hermann system, and I was their chief quality and informatics officer. That's like a CMIO, but you put quality in the title, and I worked on their clinically integrated network, their ACO, their population health infrastructure. And we were successful in that group. I think that every success that you have is because of a group. You never want to say, oh, I led or anything. We led the team, a fantastic team there. And we were a Medicare Shared Savings Program ACO. And we were the most successful financially in the country for the first 3 years of the program, with over $90 million in incentive payments to our organization, with 2,000 physicians who had chosen to participate in it. We were incredibly fortunate. We worked with independent doctors. 90% of them were independent. And so we were wildly successful. And like most people who are wildly successful, at some point you decide, oh, well, I could go help other people. So I was a consultant for about a year and a half with Premier out of Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was a vice president for clinical performance improvement and applied analytics. So I continued my doctor data nerd stuff, but I also went around the country and helped people with quality improvement projects and those sort of things. And then 2.5 years ago, I had the opportunity to come to URAC and be the president and CEO. And honestly, the choice of coming to URAC was because it made me uncomfortable. It made me nervous and scared. I had some other options of places I could go and basically do what I had done in Houston, but I thought, I've been there, I've done that. And for a lot of the times where I face a career choice, one of the things that I try and think through is, if I'm wildly successful in this role, how much of an effect can I have on healthcare? And this goes all the way back to when I was a primary care physician. If you're a doctor practicing all the time, you can maybe touch 6,000 people in a year with your stethoscope. That's the number that you can directly care for as a physician. But when I became a CMIO, I helped take care of everybody in that system, you know, several hundred thousand a year. And when I went to Houston, it was several million at a time that we were helping to take care of. And when I came here, I thought, you know, I can actually influence care across the entire country. And to have the ability to have an influence on quality and to help people to navigate their way to quality and understand what quality looks like made me come here. The other thing was that it challenged me. I'd never been a CEO before. And I think that when you try something, you know, is it going to build new muscles that you haven't done before? And that was one of the reasons why I came to do this. And strangely enough, after I came here, because of our success in telemedicine and some of the things that we do, we actually had people come to us internationally and ask for us to work with them on accreditation. So it's not just influencing care in the United States now. We influence care in Africa, in the Middle East, in South America, those sort of things. And it's just remarkable to think that you go from this small town kid in rural Iowa wanting to be a family practice doctor to now where you're helping to write the standards for care across the world.
All right. So I absolutely love just that entire storyline. And that's exactly as you told that story, Sean, that's where my head was connecting. It was like, wow, small town, you know, you thought you were going to be at Friday night football games. And to your point, I mean, now you're influencing standards for the entire world. Without even setting you up for it, one of the major take homes that I want to just call out for our audience, because our audience is a really good mix of healthcare quality professionals and healthcare administrators, but all of, you know, my audience members are still pushing forward in their careers. And everything what you said about the reason why you took that CEO position with URAC is because it made you uncomfortable. And so that's a mindset. I just want to call that out for our audience as you all continue to push forward in your career, whatever's coming next. Look for those opportunities that are going to put you in a very unique spot. And I promise your breakthroughs are going to come, but you have to put yourself in those positions when you get the chance. So I love that entire story, entire dialogue. Dr. Griffin, let me move you into this next question, because this is a little bit of a fan favorite also. So I want to get you to take us back on a journey through your entire healthcare leadership career. And share with us what you would consider to be your best moment of failure. If you could give us, you know, the story, kind of the background on that event, but most importantly, give us the major lessons learned that you took from it.
Okay. So, you know, the good news is that there've been multiple failures in my career. And I think that people sometimes gloss over those types of things because there's failures and there's setbacks. And when you're a physician, I'm going to take you through one in particular. One of the harder points in my career. And I don't talk about this very often. So look out, here we go. So when I moved from Missouri to Houston, I was hired as the first chief medical information officer for Baylor College of Medicine. Baylor at that time was working on building a hospital in the Texas Medical Center. They had previously worked in another hospital. They were looking to build their own medical campus. And this was in 2008. And I don't know if you guys recall, but in 2008, the economy sort of crashed. And Baylor College of Medicine was in this incredible financial position. They had money in the bank. They were building this hospital. And in the span of about 6 months, their money in the bank kind of got cut in half. And they suddenly did not have the money to be building this hospital at that time. And most of the people who were in the leadership team had been brought in to build this hospital. And that was really sort of my area of expertise. And so I was working along and I'm doing all this sort of stuff with implementing the medical record system and these things. And I had moved my family. I have five sons. And so I had uprooted my family and moved from small town Missouri to Houston, Texas. And we were living there and working all this sort of stuff. And I went into my weekly one-on-one with my boss. And I had the unfortunate experience of walking into the room and suddenly realizing, hey, for some reason, there's an HR person in the room with me right now who doesn't normally come to my one-on-ones. I wonder what this is about. And it had never been in my mindset as a physician to think that you were going to get laid off. Okay. So I'm very successful in Missouri, very comfortable in Missouri, go to Houston, you know, going to take something that's going to challenge me. And about a year into it, I get the pink slip. And it's a restructuring, and it was because the economy crashed. It wasn't anything I did. There was no trouble or anything like that. But I was devastated. I was just absolutely punch in the gut. You know, what have I done? I went home to my wife and I said, honey, you know, we may need to move back to Missouri. I may need to go back into practice and go back with my tail between my legs, because this has just devastated me. All of these dreams that I had. I mean, I had architectural plans for an informatics area in the new hospital, and it was just thrilling. And I went home and just shot in the gut, just felt terrible. And my wife was incredibly supportive, you know, don't worry, we're going to figure it out. We're going to work through these things, that sort of stuff. But as a physician, you never expect to get laid off. And I was getting laid off. And I went home and I immediately started calling friends, you know, people that I knew, connections that I had, all that sort of stuff. And I reached out to a friend of mine at Memorial Hermann, a great guy there, who I won't name anything, just to keep him anonymous. But he said, Sean, don't do anything. He said, don't overreact to this. He said, these things happen. He said, give me a little bit of time. And he called me back 2 hours later. And he said, Sean, I've got this great thing for you. We have an interview set up for you tomorrow morning at 7:30 in the morning, where we're going to talk to you about maybe bringing you over here to Memorial Hermann. And in that moment, I said to him, I said, you know, goodness, I just got laid off today. Don't I get to sleep in tomorrow and pout for a little bit longer? And he said, no, I've got some things lined up. Don't commit to anything else, because he knew I wanted to stay in Houston and we were old friends, and he knew some of the stuff that I was doing. And so he knew I hadn't done anything wrong. It's just that the economy had taken out my position. And for me, one of the lessons was, you can be doing everything right and still suffer a setback. And that can feel really hard, because you want the world to be fair, and sometimes it's not. And sometimes you lack perspective as to the change that you're going through, because every time I've had a setback, I've ended up better in my next version. And even with, you know, in my current job, I've said to my wife and I've said to people around me, I said, I have never enjoyed a job as much as I enjoy this job. Now, it's not the same as when I was in the office seeing patients and those sort of things. And there's things about that I absolutely miss. I mean, if you're a clinician and you do that for a while, you know, you miss the connections, you miss seeing the real changes that you make for people. I mean, it's kind of tough to go from, you know, saving lives to setting up a strategic plan. I mean, they're just not quite the same thing. And so, you know, every setback can be a reset. And as you think about this, there have been multiple times in my career where I've gone to my wife and I said, you know, I can't imagine it getting any better than it is right now. And every single time I've been blessed enough to where it's been better when I go down the road a little while.
No, perfect. And again, I think that story right there is going to resonate big time with our audience because, I mean, you have stories of setback. You have stories of leadership, being in a leadership position, creating a vision, not seeing the vision, you know, come to fruition just because of the environment around you. Stories of adversity in the moment. Also, I want to highlight the power of networks. First, you know, having the comfort, the relationship, obviously, with your wife to have that you know, personal dialogue about, all right, you know, babe, something's about to change for us. But then the power of your network with your colleague that you can reach out to. And, you know, even if an opportunity wasn't there, just having somebody to connect with and talk through the situation. So the power of networks, those are things that I do try to drive home or, you know, kind of point out every chance I get with this podcast, because again, that's the stuff that I think all healthcare leaders need to understand is that, like you said, you know, we have the vision, we know where we want to go, but life's not always fair. The day-to-day work is not always fair.
Yeah.
How do we come back? And I'm glad you didn't get a chance to sleep in and pout, but you know, you're right back on the ball, new opportunity. And so you move forward from that. So I appreciate that story. And again, I think that's going to resonate pretty well.
Well, and there's several things in there. I've had the opportunity in the past to speak to early CMIOs, chief medical information officers, and I talk with them. I say, about your career, I said, no one's going to manage your career for you. Mm. And some of just the basic things that you need to do is whatever position you're in, you need to think about what you love about it, what you don't like about it, what kind of position you could see yourself moving into if you care about advancing. I think that sometimes we all buy into the fact that we need to be constantly advancing and those sort of things. And there's actually a value to staying in a position for a while and getting really good at it and demonstrating your expertise before you jump to the next thing. I mean, when I interview people for positions, if they're hopping every, you know, year and a half, I'm like, well, goodness gracious, I'm not expecting you to stick around. Why would I invest in you? So you can't look like you're always trying to jump from step to step. I always say, you know, you should update your resume every year. At least once a year, you want to pull out your resume, you want to update it, make sure that it's reflective of what you're currently doing. And that's not just for job, that's for if you're going to give a speaking engagement or those sort of things, you know, just to make sure that it's reflective of what you're doing. The other thing that's really funny is you should make friends. One of the things that I try and do when I give talks is very often I use my personal email address. And I think you heard me say this the other day when we were doing our a webinar, is if you have a question, if you have something where you think my expertise could help you, or you just want to check on something, I said, with my varied background, I've done a lot of stuff. I still get a couple emails a week from people that maybe heard me speak 5 years ago, and they're like, hey, Sean, we're working on this thing in population health. Can you help me out with some of these ideas? Because being a resource for people is a great way to network and to share and to extend. And then a real practical piece of advice is copy all of your work contacts and take them home once a year as a document, because if all of a sudden, you know, the computer system crashes and you lose everybody, you've got to reestablish those connections. But also, if you get fired, you know, you need to know, you know, wait a minute, I had that person's email address, but it was at work. I don't have a copy of it any other place. In the old days, you know, you used to have to print it out or keep a CD of it. I think I still have some old CDs of my old contacts. But make sure that you are transferring your contacts to a device that you would keep if your business shut down tomorrow.
So I love it. I literally have what I call my go file. And this is from all of my positions, to your point. I mean, projects, contacts, all of the above. Love the advice. I have to double down on what you said about updating your resume at least once a year. It keeps you up to date with where you are and your progress. Again, it's not all about finding the new job, but it's still about growth. You know, I still would push some form of personal growth. You know, you'll see where your skills are, and then you may come up with a goal. Hey, let me add on one new certification, or let me try to attend one conference this year or present. So All exceptional advice, Sean. Thank you so much for all of that, man. Getting more than I paid for with this. No, Sean, let me dig you out of the dark place. And I want to move you to the next question, where I love if you could share with us a tip, tool, or tactic that you found works really well for building intimate connections with the teams that you lead. Just share with us what it is and how do you apply it.
Okay. Some of this goes back to the coaching aspect. Whether you're leading a team or whether you're on a team, you really need to understand the skills of the people that you're working with. And the skills also include their personality tendencies. One of the things, I'm not a huge sort of Myers-Briggs or anything like that, but I can tell you that going through some of those things at times will give you information that will help you deal with people that maybe you didn't have before. With my team here, we've done some work where we've taken a look at the executive team. And one of the things that we did is we did some analysis about how they function when things are good, and then how they function when things are bad. You know, what sort of behaviors do you see them come out? And just from experience, I mean, you know, there are some people that you work with them, and when things get, you know, tougher at home or something like that, they bring it into work and you start seeing behaviors that maybe you aren't used to seeing when things are going good at home. And the same thing in the job, when they feel pressure, you know, when your CFO says you missed the numbers for the month or something like that, there are some people who it's almost like they change into a different person. And no matter who you're having to work with, understanding them and understanding how they respond is really important, because there are some people who when they get stressed, they become a control freak. And there's other people who, when they get stressed, they become a little snippy, or they become, you know, snappy at you, or those sort of things. And understanding the reaction from the motivation is really important for working with anybody on a team. I mean, I can tell you that when I am really tired and it's been, you know, several long days in a row, I get a little mouthier with people on my, you know, I get a little less building of my team. You know, I might say something like, well, it's about time, you know, as opposed to, I'm really glad you did that, you know, and we need to understand that. And building a relationship, a friendship as best you can with the people that you work with, and yet not giving up your responsibility. You know, there are times where if you're leading a team, you still need to hold people accountable, but you need to do it in a way that doesn't crush them. One of the things that I do quite a bit of, and people will say, "Oh, is that some leadership technique?" It's no, I'm joking and I'm friendly. And sometimes I will make a joke about something, and there's a little sliver of truth in it. And in a joke, you can get away with saying something that you couldn't say to them directly. You know, sort of like the I haven't seen you in the office in a while. You doing okay? As opposed to, we really want to see you in the office. But I mean, just in daily life, in speaking with people, being able to communicate effectively is incredibly important, because, you know, the best person in the world by themselves is the best person in the world, and they don't affect anybody. But if you aren't able to communicate, and if you're not able to understand where people are and help them at times, the world is really messy. I mean, it's kind of tough living these days for almost everybody in different ways. And one of the things that we did as an organization after I first came is we updated our organizational values. And the number one value that I felt was important as we went through this was our number one value as an organization is we value people. And when I say we value people, there's multiple layers to that. We value the people that we work with. We're not going to run over people. I've worked for people in the past who did a fantastic job of achieving things, but they chewed up the people who did the work. And I think that's not respectful. I value people incredibly. So there's the people that you work with. There's the people that you work with outside of your organization. You know, we work with clients who are going through accreditation, and our job is not to shame them into changing their behavior. It's about showing them a way that they can do better. And then we also recognize that as a healthcare organization, we work with people who care for people. You know, this is not a machine shop where we're making industrial gears. You know, this is where we're trying to improve healthcare so that, you know, a diabetic person keeps their vision, so that a person who's going through surgery doesn't end up with an infection, so that a telemedicine visit isn't simply a vending machine where you get the prescription that you want so that you pay your $40 and put a good review on Yelp or anything like that. And so you have to keep those things in perspective. I also think it's incredibly important that we recognize that for some people, their motivations may not be the same as yours. I work with some people who are in healthcare because they're simply in healthcare. It's simply their starting job. That's not where they want to be. You know, maybe they dream of Wall Street. And I say, you know, if you don't understand that we care about people, and if you don't care about people, you're not going to be happy here. You know, it's not that you're going to go into healthcare and you're going to be a bajillionaire or anything like that. It's you're probably going to make a comfortable living, and but you'll actually make a difference in people's lives in a way that you wouldn't otherwise.
Love all of those insights. I usually, you know, I'm usually taking notes and trying to come back with ways to extend, you know, or add on to everything you're saying. I'm just like, I just want to listen, man. You're dropping a lot of great knowledge. So thank you for all of that. So I'm going to move you into this next question again, just to learn kind of how a lot of fortunes, a lot of different opportunities may have come together for you, but would love to ask, what's the best aha moment that you've had as a healthcare leader? But again, maybe share with us, how did that moment come about? And definitely if you were able to turn it into a personal or a professional success.
So I'm going to take you all the way back to being a full-time family practice doctor in Missouri. And this actually builds on something that I said before, because that idea of taking care of more people. Actually, I got two stories that I'm going to stick in here. One of them is going back to the fifth grade when I talked about becoming a doctor. And that's when I made that decision, that naive decision that I'm going to become a doctor. I had a fifth grade teacher who I love and revere to this day. Her name was Mrs. Heyer. And Mrs. Heyer was my fifth grade teacher. And honestly, in the fifth grade, I was that kid who sat in class and maybe caused a little bit of trouble. Now, this is small town Iowa. So the trouble that you caused in the back row of class was pretty minor as things go. I mean, this is not, you know, devastating or hacking or anything like that. But Mrs. Heyer noticed that I was causing trouble in class, and she took the opportunity to get to know me. And when she got to know me, she discovered that I was bored out of my mind. Okay. I'm a really fast learner. I always like challenges and discovery and those sort of things. And I'm sitting in the back row of class, and she's trying to teach me something that I knew 5 years ago, and I'm just bored. So I'm causing trouble. And so she got to know me. And one of the things that she did, also during that time, my parents were going through a divorce, and it was very disturbing as a fifth grade boy going through a divorce for his family in a small town where everybody knows. Other than that, it was fantastic. But she got to know me. And one of the things that she discovered is that other kids were picking on me. Because of what we were going through. Money was not good for us as a family. And so one of the things that she did is she said, Sean, when you're done with your in-class assignments, you're allowed to get up to burn off some of my energy. She was very smart. And you're allowed to help other kids. And so she actually turned me a little bit into an aide in her classroom. And that did two things for me. I mean, it gave me a motivation to get my work done and go help people, but it showed me the value of helping people. And it also meant that the kids in the class who might have picked on me at recess were now asking me for help with their work. And that turned the dynamic in the room a little bit. And then after that happened, she said, you know, Sean, also, we're starting this talented and gifted program for kids in school, and our school had not had anything like that before. And I want you to be on the team. And that gave me a chance to be creative and to think about things and that sort of stuff. And it was just really remarkable because it gave me an outlet. And we were very successful in this program. And we reached some state recognition and those sort of things. And I got to know kids in the grade ahead and my grade. And again, it was a chance to show my expertise. And when all that all got done and we were coming towards the end of the year, she confronted me with something. And this is one of the great moments of my life. She said, Sean, I've gotten to know you. Your mind works differently than a lot of people, and you have a lot of gifts. She said, the rest of your life, you're going to have to make a decision about whether you use your gifts to serve yourself or to serve others. I mean, think about putting that kind of question to a fifth grade kid.
Yeah.
and it was just remarkable. And I can't say, well, from then on, I cured cancer. You know, it was not something like that. But prior to the fifth grade, my choice of career was, like most mature people, I wanted to be a stuntman in Hollywood and crash cars and jump off of buildings. And that was just me sort of going, what would be cool? And in the fifth grade, I saw Hawkeye Pierce on MASH, and he helped people. He was funny. People liked him. And the other thing, just to be transparent, is in my hometown, we had some physicians, we had some physicians assistants. And one of the things I knew about them is that they took really good family holidays. And I thought, so there must be some money in being a physician. And so that was another reason why I wanted to be a physician, is because I thought, you know, I could make money, I could take care of my family, maybe we could take some good vacations. So I decided to become a doctor, go through all this, become a physician, and then I'm in my office seeing one of my elderly patients in St. Joe all these years later. And she says to me, she says, Dr. Griffin, at this time, my administrative time was going up, my clinical time was going down. And so some of my patients weren't able to get in to see me. And she said, Dr. Griffin, you know, I have trouble getting into you in the office. Is it that you've stopped wanting to see patients anymore? And honestly, to have one of my dear patients say this to me was a little bit of an ouch. I mean, I didn't mean to hurt you with what I was doing, but I owed her an explanation. And this is that variation on the explanation I gave you before. I said, there's a couple things. I said, I can take care of 6,000 people directly per year, or I can take what I know and build in safety so that everybody within my system is taking better care of all the people that they see. And I said, that's a real way to take better care of more people. And at the time I had 5 children, I have 5 sons. And the other thing I said to her, I said, I'm also not allowed to take care of my own family as a physician. I'm not allowed to do that. And some night, one of my kids is going to be in somebody else's office or in an emergency room, and there's going to be something going on. And I can be in that room at that time because I helped build the systems that take care of them in that moment. And that's why I'm less in the clinic and more doing things administratively. And at that time, like I said, I was going from 6,000 patients I could touch to maybe a couple 100,000 that the system would touch in St. Joseph, Missouri. And to again, take that to whatever population now we're influencing the care on across the US and across the world. Those are some of the key moments where you actually have a little bit better perspective as to what's going to matter in the meantime. And one last thing on this is with a lot of my jobs, I say, if I'm wildly successful, what will I accomplish? And when I face the choice of you know, leading an ACO or a clinically integrated, and there's fantastic people who can do those things, you know, I've been in the position where we had the most successful ACO and we were doing great work and we were improving quality and that sort of stuff in a community, which at the time was Houston. You know, is it that much different to be running an ACO in Atlanta or, you know, Los Angeles? The best you can do is influence that community. And that's one of the reasons why I came here, is to influence a community of the entire United States.
Sean, I'm saying, man, I am over here just geeking out, taking notes, so enthralled and inspired by your entire story. So, man, you share so much. So the last thing you said that just stuck out: if I am wildly successful, what will that look like? Again, I just want to pinpoint that for our audience, especially as you take opportunities to make yourselves uncomfortable and ask yourself that, if I'm wildly successful, what does that look like? Your mindset for, you know, making the trade-offs that you had to make, but seeing the bigger picture for the impact that you can make, phenomenal. Your story about Mrs. Heyer, love it, man. That's so, so amazing, especially at fifth grade. I'm just curious to ask, does Mrs. Heyer know what you do today? Has she had the opportunity to kind of see your path?
Mrs. Heyer passed away several years ago. Okay. And she passed away when I was still practicing in Missouri, so she never saw the next steps or any of those sort of things. But actually, here in my office in Washington, D.C., I don't have a lot of wall space. But over on the wall, as I sit here, is a little decorative P. Buckley Moss plate that Mrs. Heyer gave me. It's called the Young Medics. And she gave it to me at medical school graduation. She sent it to me, gave it through my family. And when I was thinking about all the things that I put up on my wall, I've got, you know, diplomas and family practice certification awards and those sort of things. And I've got Mrs. Heyer's P. Buckley Moss gift of the Young Medics to remind me about how people matter.
Fantastic. Man, I love it. Let me ask one more question, and then I'm going to move us down into kind of our rapid fire area. I want to make sure I don't go over my time with you just to kind of go there. But again, just fantastic information and really enjoying this conversation with you. Sean, the next question I have for you is, what are some of the current changes going on in the healthcare industry that you're personally excited about? And what role do you see, you know, quality professionals, but I'll even kind of zoom up a little bit and just say, healthcare leaders, big picture, playing to promote or to support as longevity?
Well, the pandemic has created all of these incredible changes, and there's been terrible suffering. And I want to give a shout out to everybody who's been involved in care directly, and all those things. It's just been tremendous sacrifices by so many people, and there's been so much suffering. There's also been a tremendous amount of innovation that has happened during the pandemic, telemedicine, remote patient monitoring, the development of vaccines as quickly as they were, I think is just remarkable. One of the reasons of coming to DC is because years ago when I was in different places, I would say we could be doing this fantastic work in our community, and then somebody in Washington, DC moves a comma and makes it so you can't do that anymore. And one of the things that sometimes gets glossed over a little bit is the effect of payment and policy on what you can do in practice. And so I think that as we look at what's going on, I mean, I've been involved in value-based payments. I've seen how those can change the dynamics. Fee-for-service creates some perverse incentives where doing the right thing doesn't pay for itself, and trying to do those things. I think... one of the things that, as I think about here, and I'm afraid I'm not going to answer your question directly, is that, the safety net of medical care available to huge amounts of the population is in real danger. It's in real danger from how things are paid for, how things are staffed. The rural hospital closures that we have seen around the United States concern me greatly. Underserved areas. When I was training, underserved areas meant rural areas, but then I was in Houston and I saw underserved areas could be right next to the freeway. So I have a different appreciation. That's why I say underserved areas as opposed to rural areas. I think that primary care and the role of primary care continues to be challenged because we have fewer doctors going into primary care than most population analysts would say that we need. So I have a primary care bias. But watching what telemedicine is something you and I have talked about before, and I think that it's an area that holds tremendous possibility. It like anything else in medicine, there are people who will abuse it, who will misuse it, but that doesn't mean it's bad. But I'm hopeful that here in Washington, D.C., there will be support for continued telemedicine greater than it was before the pandemic, but recognizing that they may need to put some volume controls or those sort of things in it. And we're trying to be very involved and supportive here in D.C. As legislators and groups talk to us about what we see in the future. I'm actually on a National Quality Forum task force around telemedicine and rural preparedness that I think is really important for some of the recommendations that will come out of that. I think that as we look at this, this horrible suffering associated with the pandemic also forced some innovation that had maybe been slow moving. And we need to take the learnings from that and not say, hey, we're going back to where we were, but what could we do better now that we've been through what we've been through?
Well, and do me a favor, if you could recall, you said this on our session that we did earlier this week. But kind of where telemedicine itself is going next, especially when it comes to maybe some of the focus with our policymakers, is that if we hear words like fraud and so forth, that means we may not get the right support. But if we hear words like value and quality, can you just say that for our listeners? Because I thought the way you said it had me like, oh, now I know what I need to listen out for. And I love to.
So when you look at policy, any changes in Washington, D.C., there's often different camps, and different camps will have sort of their go-to phrases and things that they emphasize that sort of telegraph. It's like a poker game, what's their tell and what are they saying is going to happen. When it comes to telemedicine, the two main camps, and this is a little bit of an oversimplification, but it may be useful, if you hear people talking about fraud, waste, and abuse concerns in telemedicine, that probably means they're going to dial it back. If they're talking about quality, equity, and access, they're probably going to dial it up, because it depends on what you're emphasizing as to how you're framing what you're going to do. Because if, oh my gosh, it's full of fraud, we better do less of it. Oh, wait, it's giving tremendous access opportunities, we better do more of it. So when you hear people talking about it, and especially with some of the huge bills that are under consideration right now, the other thing is that states are doing things different than the federal government. So your state may be promoting telemedicine in a good way, or they may be dialing it back. Everybody who pays for healthcare is concerned about, is telemedicine just another thing that's not going to improve care or lower costs? And so how do you put in controls to make sure that you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater when you're trying to put some controls on this?
All right, perfect. Yeah, and the conversation that we had the other day, especially with our additional panelists that were involved, really my takeaway was, again, for our audience, but just for me personally, get involved, or, you know, at least have an appreciation and understanding of what's going on federally with the different policies, and listen for those tales like you just shared. But then to your other point, listening statewide, we had a state level leader on the call with us. And she represented Georgia. And I mean, literally, she's right down the road from me. Yeah. And the things she shared were things I wasn't familiar with. Yeah. So really good takeaways.
Yeah, the importance of engaging with your local and state legislatures and regulators is incredibly important and underappreciated by most people, because you can have the best facts in the world, but telling a state regulator or legislator about how whatever you care about, whether it be telemedicine, just as an example here, if you can share with them a story as to how telemedicine has made a positive impact on somebody in their community, that's going to stick with them much more than, oh, the satisfaction was 94% versus 88% in person. You know, stats give you detail, but stories give you memories. And that's really what you need to be sharing. If whatever it is, if you feel passionately about it, getting a connection and speaking with the person who represents you in particular, they listen to a person from their community 20 times more than some national expert who they don't know.
Right, fantastic. Sean, thank you for that. Let me move you into a few of these extra kind of rapid fire Q&As.
So you want short answers is what you're really trying to tell me.
Yeah, okay. I'm getting you right there on the spot to make sure I get these last 5 or so minutes in with you. So the first question is something of a two-parter. And I'd love for you to first tell our quality people something about your current role that inspires you to do your best. And then also share with us, how do you inspire others in your organization?
So something about my current role that inspires me. Those of you who are familiar with the vaccines for COVID, when they first came out, one of the real concerns was keeping the vaccine cold enough so that it maintained its efficacy throughout the supply chain. Many of those standards that were used for the COVID vaccine were actually first written up by URAC years ago, when it came to the cold chain rules for specialty pharmacies and how to do the documentation and how to maintain that sort of chain of cold safety. And to be here at URAC at a time when they're like, oh, we got to keep it at, you know, minus 240 degrees. And it's like, you know, to talk to the person down the hall who helped write those standards 10 years ago was incredibly inspiring. Something that I use to inspire others is, when I came in here, I came in from outside the organization, and one of the things that I thought was really important was to share my personal story. I've actually had pushback in different ways of that, but I think people getting to know you is always a good thing. It does open you up where people can say, I mean, I've had people say, oh, he brags about his kids too much, or you know, that sort of thing. It's like, if you don't know me, if you don't understand what makes me a person, then I doubt you're going to care about what makes me a leader. And so I think that's really important that as we do that we not be so stiff and so guarded that people don't get to know us. And then we should do that back with other people. Just before I got on this podcast, I was speaking with a person who works here in the office, and they're in the office today. And I know that they have a newborn at home, and I know personally what that is like to have that. And so, you know, sort of the, hey, how you doing? Are you getting enough sleep? Those sort of things can be a real motivator, because it's hard living life these days, like I said.
All right, wonderful. And best piece of career advice that you've ever received?
I think you know what you know what you don't know. Don't be afraid to be uncomfortable, as long as what you're being uncomfortable for is worth it if you achieve it.
All right, love it. And could you share a personal habit that contributes to your success when leading quality or other initiatives that you lead?
I think whatever your job is, you need to understand it well, and you need to understand what's required to understand it well. When I was a chief medical information officer, there were times where I had to know the finest detail in technical specifications on quality reporting and those sort of things and learn the tricks. There were other times in my current role, I need to stay at the level where I'm most useful. Okay. I once had a boss tell me, if I have to tell you everything that you need to do, why do I need you? I could just be doing it. And so, you know, when I come into the office, my kids pick on me. They say, you spend all day reading the internet. Well, I probably have five or six different updates that I go through every morning, taking a look at policy, taking a look at quality, taking a look at those things that I didn't need to know when I was working on projects. If you're working on a project, know that project well, know the implications of that project, but you probably don't need to worry about the consumer price index in Denmark or something like that. Whereas I need to cover everything from, you know, there's a hearing this afternoon in Wyoming where they're going to be talking about specialty pharmacy. Also, by the way, you know, here's this business development opportunity that we have. So understand your area. Don't just say that, never ever in your job say that's not my responsibility.
All right, perfect. And I'm just going to go completely off script with this next question. But what are some resources for members in our audience, other healthcare leaders, quality process improvement professionals? What are some good resources that they can plug into based on the world that you're leading in? To your point, are there just things that they can do and get their own research going?
So a couple things I'm just going to throw out here. So I'm a member of the American Academy of Family Physicians. I'm no longer practicing. I still stay in touch with them. I still read their newsletters. I think that LinkedIn is a good source for business in general. I think that whatever you're interested in or involved in, you should get in touch with advocacy groups who focus on that area. Telemedicine, the American Telemedicine Association is a great group that sort of advocates on the behalf of that. But whatever you're working on, whether it be NQF, National Quality Forum, whether it be IHI, you know, there's a lot of really incredible groups that are doing fantastic work. I'm honored that I get to go from the person who used to read their newsletter to the person who gets to sit on their committees. And then work on building yourself up. You have strengths, you have weaknesses. For some of your weaknesses, you can cover for them. For others, you need to make them a little bit stronger, but you're never going to be great at them. But you need to understand what are the pitches that you need to be able to hit in your job, and not just in your job now, but the job that you want to go to. And think about, this may sound strange, think about the job you would want to go into and look at the job descriptions that you see for open positions about that, because very often they'll talk about what they think are the qualifications for that job, and you may not have thought of them. You may dream of being an NFL quarterback, but if you've never learned to throw a football, they're probably not going to hire you even when they have the opportunity.
All right, perfect. And this very last question, Sean, this is a personal favorite because I'm going to ask you to reflect on your past while you look forward to your future. So let's say you have a chance to send yourself a text to yourself 10 years in the past and one text message to yourself 10 years into the future. Take a second and think about it, but what do you communicate in each of those messages?
I think that there's some similarities in those two messages. I think that I remind myself that you want to focus on doing work that's meaningful. And focusing on work that's meaningful and taking care of the people around you, and it's going to work out. And I will tell you that I never could have imagined that it would work out in the way that it has worked out for me. This is not the path I would have charted when I was in the fifth grade or thinking about being a doctor or those sort of things. But every step forward and every step back has led me to the step that I'm on now. And I think that, the other thing that guides a lot of what I do is my faith, and I won't get too far into that, but I believe that people are incredibly valuable and it's a blessing to work with them. And if my blessing on people that I'm working with is simply a smile or an encouragement, then I need to take care of the people around me, and we need to be focused on doing work that's meaningful if we accomplish it.
Well, I tell you, it's so impactful. I think it says something, at least with the space that I'm in, because that's the second time I've heard that message from a senior leader like yourself around doing work that is impactful. So that's just a connection that just personally sits well on me with the conversations I've been able to have with leaders like yourself, and then making an impact on people and having faith to, you know, ground you with the things you're doing. Love that message. Sean, I can't thank you enough for just this one additional conversation that I get to have with you this week alone. Before I let you go, and I apologize, I know we're 2-3 minutes past my time, but I would love if you could just give our quality people that parting piece of advice. Share with us the best way to connect or follow you or any other information or things you would want to highlight for UREC overall, and then we'll officially sign off.
Okay. So I just want to say that if you're working on quality, you are doing noble work. And that, you know, I'm out there on LinkedIn. My email address is sgriffin@urec.org. You can find me and throw me a note. Let me know that how you came across me and that sort of stuff. If you try and sell me something, I'll be a little disappointed in you because I get those all the time. But people who really want to connect or those sort of things, or honestly, you know, just a 5-minute phone call just to catch up, you know, throw me a note. We can set up something. You may have questions. I think that we can all use help and I'm here to help. Please recognize the value in what you do. Whatever quality work you're doing is meant to serve people. And that is noble no matter where it is. And thank you for your hard work. This has been an incredibly tough year. Take some time for yourself. No job is greater than your value. So if you don't take care of yourself, you can't take care of your job. But don't be selfish and mean. There's too much of that going around these days. So, I mean, Jarvis, I came on here because you and I had talked before, and I think this is a great thing to do. I don't mind going over a couple minutes to talk about good stuff. So thank you for this invite and for this time.
Absolutely. Sean, thank you again. All of the insights, the words of wisdom, all of the wonderful, wonderful stories. Truly appreciate that. To our quality people everywhere, thank you all for listening and making us a part of your day. This is Jarvis and Dr. Sean Griffin, and we're signing off.
Thank you.
Quality people, thank you so much again for plugging in with today's episode. If you enjoyed it, please feel free to share it using the social media link posted in the notes below. I'd also be very grateful if you could subscribe, give us a rating, and also share feedback on what additional value we can bring to you through this podcast. That helps a lot with our show rankings and also with getting this great content out to healthcare leaders around the world. And if you want to engage with me directly, then please connect with me on LinkedIn, where I share additional resources, access to our QI community, and much more. All right, quality people, thank you again, and I'll see you back here next week when I introduce you to another quality guest.